FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and well, today is April 8th, 2020, and I recorded this interview with Danielle yesterday afternoon, and we're getting it up as quickly as we can, but the map, it was bright red a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago. Now it's starting to get orange, light orange. And does that mean the end of the pandemic is near? Well, the stock market, maybe it's telling us that, maybe not. Should you pay attention? I'm not sure. But what you should do is send us an email with your opinion on whether the coronavirus has peaked, at least here in the States. And what do you think is going to happen next? And the email address, kl@kerrylutz.com, kl@kerrylutz.com. So, Danielle, it's great to have you back. So, hey, the market is recovering. You think it's just a snapback kind of rally, a slingshot, and it's then gonna retrace a bit and then go back?
Well, we have, at the end of March, we did our client letter and we had bounce back targets baked in because, first of all, we had the sharpest 30% decline ever in the history of markets, as you know, Kerry.
Yes.
And that typically when you get a washout like that, you should expect to get a counter trend rally because the most shorted stocks, the Boeings and Carnivals and all the things that people had, you know, were trying to make money on as they fell, were the biggest buybacks in the past couple of days. So we're seeing strong rallies in the names that were shorted, and it's across the board. So I think that that's part of what drives these bear market rallies. But at this point, the long-term trend remains down in terms of weekly and monthly. We're talking about daily charts where we've come up. My partner, Corey, had a retest in the, you know, 27, 25 area for the S&P 500, and we're basically in that band now. But I was just looking at some interesting stats. So we've had a 7% surge in the S&P 500 six other times in the past 70 years, and all of them were during bear markets. That's the first thing. So when you see what we've had in the past couple of days, that falls in that group. And then secondly, the average counter trend rally after a decline like we had takes place over a median of 11 days. So again, we've seen a couple of days here, but that doesn't a trend break, so to speak, when it comes to a bear market. So I think that we, you know, certainly can't conclude that we're out of the woods here yet. And the rallies typically end up a median of 52%. So there's this retracement of the loss by up to 52% on average over the median is 11 days. So I think we should watch this very closely. But, you know, a rebound, even if after you've fallen 37%, which it was at the worst of March 23rd, you know, if you have a rebound of half that, that would be quite typical of these type of periods in history. But you know what, the other thing is that we need to keep in mind is we were fully into bear market territory here. This wasn't just a correction. This was actually a bear market. Whereas we had correction periods in 16 and 18, you know, where they were more than 10%, but just kind of shy of 20. But 37 is a full on bear market with huge technical damage and ramifications. And also not just in stocks, Kerry, this was a credit market event as we've seen, yes, and as I've been talking about on the blog, across levered loans, across mortgages, across private equity, every kind of credit, we saw blowing out of spreads between the best investment grade quality and the rest, so to speak. So those things haven't repaired, and liquidity is still very tight. Let's not forget the reason that we've seen any even continued functioning in these markets is because of unprecedented trillions of dollars that have been thrown at the investment banks again, right, who then don't want to lend money in this environment, frankly. You know, everyone's asking for deferrals on their payments, and, you know, you've got unemployment spiking potentially. It's about 13% in both Canada and the U.S. on the latest data. Coming into April is likely to be about 13%. So there's not a lot of appetite for new loans here, and there's not a lot of appetite for lending. So you get this sort of liquidity floating around in financial markets. And I think the jury is still fully out. I would expect we'll see, you know, a rally for potentially even a few more days, and then we'll see where we're at. But, you know, here's the other thing. We were talking off air about the progression of the virus spread and where it's topped. And you were saying you think in Florida that it's already peaked and all that stuff. I was just noting that since March 30, when you look at the Johns Hopkins website, the incidents between now and March 30, so just over a week, worldwide reported cases almost doubled from 826,000 to 1.36 million, basically, and then deaths did about the same. So I think the thing that markets maybe are not wanting to appreciate yet, perhaps because of liquidity drunk or because of the covering of shorts, is the reality that although we may get a, you know, social distancing works for sure, and we're slowing the spread, and in Canada, we're all on full lockdown for exactly that purpose. Right. But the reality is that we're not going to have a cure for this thing for some time. And as soon as we try and reopen again, we're likely to have a resurgence in the incidence of contagion again, and also in the fall. So again, it's sort of an ongoing train wreck that we're all kind of watching. And right now we're in the full-on emergency, you know, emergency support view, which is, you know, how do we defer payments? How do we, you know, get tenants to not be kicked out when they can't pay their rent? The question then is, how do we get the economy revived again, even if we get ahead of the virus here? Because we're not going to have a bounce back in, you know, a quick bounce back. Certainly because services have become such a huge part of the economy, and services in many ways are just lost revenue, right? If you didn't get your haircut this week, you know, in June, if you can, you'll go get your haircut then, but that doesn't make up for the haircut you didn't get this week. Do you know what I'm saying? There's services, there's just plain lots of lost revenue. And I think that that has yet to be appreciated in this saga.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. And speaking of haircuts, my person who cuts my hair, and she's not in a salon, she's in like these suites that they have, each one has a private room, and I just got the news that until further notice she's closed. So like I said, well, I won't tell if you don't. Says no, I'm a rule follower, sorry.
And the other thing is, you know what, I think people have been really complacent in the past decade with all the belief in central banks. We've talked about this so much, you know, that they've got our back, that they can save anything, that they can jig the financial system so that even when the economy is very weak, you know, and we've saw a drop in earnings since 2018, we've seen the weakest GDP recovery of any cycle since in the last 100 years into 2019. So even though all that was happening, there was this belief that central banks somehow could jimmy rig the system. And I think now we're seeing numbers that none of us have seen in our lifetime. And we're talking about jumps in unemployment that far surpass anything we saw in the Great Recession, that are more like 30s style. We're seeing plunges in GDP. You know, the second quarter plunge in GDP is supposed to be something like 30%, which is, you know, unprecedented. We just don't have any personal experience with this kind of an environment, nor frankly with a pandemic that, as I say, comes in ebbs and flows and impacts human behavior, changes our appetite for going out, changes our sense of anxiety around social settings, around, you know, cash flow. I think people needed something badly to instruct them on better financial prudence. And I think this is one of those things that when it scares the life out of you, you know, when you, all of a sudden you went from two jobs covering payments to potentially no income. And your savings that you did have was in financial markets that dropped 30% in a matter of days. I think this really has the potential to leave a mark in terms of behavioral shift. I hope it does, quite honestly, because people were doing some very reckless, destructive behaviors in the last few years. We're seeing it in the housing market. What's really interesting to me is we have clients across the entire, you know, specter of every kind of profession, every kind of business, you know, and basically everyone from plastic surgeons to hairdressers to, you know, people that work in auto sector, everyone has lost income over this. Everyone is facing, you know, they have big lease payments or, you know, loans on equipment that are needing to be serviced with cash flow that has just vanished. And I noticed that our insolvency experts up here who I follow quite closely and have been talking about a surge in household insolvency filings for the last couple of years. They said, you know, up until now, they were seeing primarily people that rented who were coming in at a double digit clip in terms of growth in the last year. Canada's been in a credit event for some time with too much debt. But they said that in the last couple of weeks, half of the people they're seeing are homeowners. Yeah. Right. So is a different snack bracket of this is people who overlevered housing, which is now basically completely a liquid carry because no one's going to see houses. No one's, wanting to move about. I saw Airbnb today canceled the ability to do short-term rentals, which makes sense in this environment. But this is a complete evaporation of cash flow. And I don't think anybody had it within their realm of possibility that that could be the case. Certainly not for those that had borrowed aggressively on the presumption that they would always be able to refinance, that they'd always be able to, you know, make payments with rent. And the last thing I just wanted to say about rent, I hear a lot of people talking about, well, they're deferring rent. I mean, to defer a mortgage payment is one thing, you know, to amortize that, stick it on the loan and, you know, over 25 years, you work it in. But to defer rent to me is a much more difficult idea, yes. Just in the sense of how does it help us later? You know, I get it helps now. It helps so people don't have to make payments. But if that's a debt that's owed, we've already got heavily indebted households. So adding to more rent debt doesn't seem to me to be helpful to the economy later on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It's a question that you have to, you just have to look and see the damage. It's substantial. And how fast can the world come out of it? Because literally we went from, subpar to par GDP growth. Now we've gone to a total global economic collapse. And even in China, they're back to work, but nobody's buying their stuff. And it's one thing, so what are they going to do? And they were short on cash as it was. There is this global dollar short squeeze that's still going on. So the Federal Reserve has worked up the swaps and the whole thing really, really just helicopter money, as it's called. And that can only last for so long.
Yeah. And I find it so ironic that, you know, all the technological innovation that needed to be invested in to transform the world economy for the future with, you know, renewable energy and all these great innovations that are in process and we're, you know, dying for more capital and more support. And the logic was always, oh, well, we can't afford to transform the energy system because it's a fortune. Well, look at what we're doing now with, you know, trillions of money globally. And it's not necessarily going to be sticking. We're talking about trillions of money globally to backstop consumption. Again, not the long-term investment stuff that we needed. And we've seen, you know, even before COVID-19 hit, we had a downturn in capital investment in all the big companies. Now, part of that is this whole preoccupation with financial gimmicks, which you and I have touched on many times. You know, the fact that companies were the net buyers of the stock market in the last decade and that the average, you know, investor was not involved, in fact, was trying to cash out, pay bills, you know, cover deficits, that sort of thing. So it's just, it's too bad because we're going to have this huge surge of public spending, a huge amount of debt taken on governments again. But, you know, the extent to which that's in any way transformational to the systems and operations of the future, it remains to be seen. But I think the behavioral stuff, as you touched on, the globalization aspect, how people have both workers have known they've been vulnerable to this trend for a long time, right? Because they've had flat wages and they've watched jobs leave. But now companies also appreciate that they're extremely vulnerable to having supply chains all based in foreign countries. And now governments appreciate the vulnerability to the system when we have, you know, critical things we need, not necessarily mass produced where we need them. So I think that globalization theme, the distrust of China in particular, is going to get more fuel here in this environment. I think there's going to be more pressure to do more things like investing at home rather than buyback gimmicks, which ultimately is very positive, but I think it's a risk for the stock market. You know, there's a difference here between what's good for the stock market and what's good for families and the economy overall. And right now, I would suggest to you that what's best for, you know, families and the economy overall is capital diversion away from financial gimmicks into more substantive activities and reforms. And I think that, you know, they're starting to put things like bans on buybacks connected with, you know, some of the bailout money. I think that's the thin edge of this wedge. We've been saying that was essential and inevitable because to continue the way it was absolutely insane. Mm-hmm. So it was just looking for a reason to bring back some restrictions on that very dangerous preoccupation.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we're going to have to ride this wave and see what happens here. And obviously there's going to be long-term effects, and it could be on the dollar, could be global economic growth. Obviously we'll have negative GDP growth probably worldwide for this year. So it's just going to be real interesting to see how this thing shakes out. And I don't by any means think we're at the end of it, but maybe we're getting a slight reprieve, right?
Sure. I mean, again, to the extent that people have been isolated, the spread has to slow. And it's not, you know, again, there's the issue of the virus, and then there's the issue of the underlying weakness, which has been really built up over the last decade. And so it's one thing to say, well, the virus can't last that long, and surely within a few months, things will be back to normal. The question is, to what extent will the economy be able to withstand this, you know, evaporation of income and this slow recovery for a period of time thereafter? I think the quick V idea is a pipe dream in this environment. And so at some point, you know, the two have to meet.
Yeah, the two have to meet. And we're going to find out the true extent of the damage. There's no escaping this. This is really unprecedented. Look, we've had pandemics before, even more recently. And yet, we never shut down the global economy over it. You have to go back to like World War I, the pandemic of 18 to 20, really where anything had this effect, and where really life just normal, so-called normal life shut down, and people just kind of hibernated in their homes. I mean, I know it's not unprecedented and not unheard of, but
it is in the sense of we've never had this many people on the earth who travel as much as they have, right? Transcontinental migration patterns of humans has never been the way it is with, you know, 7.8 billion people, and a pandemic as contagious as this, right? So that's, I think, what makes it fundamentally different.
Couldn't agree with you more, Danielle. And I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Like you say, the economy in Canada, even in the U.S., was slowing down. We were destined to have a recession. We had literally an 11-year bull market, unparalleled in history, and we were bound to crash hard, but nobody expected it to crash this hard. So are there any buys, screaming buys, that you see in this market yet?
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Trilogy Metals is a world-class developer in Alaska's Ambler Mining District. The company already possesses 8 billion pounds of copper, 3 billion pounds of zinc, over 1 million gold equivalent ounces, and now over 77 million pounds of cobalt. Trilogy's Arctic project boasts an after-tax net present value of $1.4 billion with a 33% IRR. Trilogy is led by an experienced management team with proven success in discovering and developing projects in Alaska. The company is well capitalized, has no debt, and possesses strong institutional support. Trilogy trades on the New York and Toronto exchanges under the ticker symbol TMQ. To learn more, go to trilogymetals.com. That's trilogymetals.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Well, we covered some of our longs that we had on the bond side, and we covered our exposure to the U.S. dollar because we'd made 40% since 2011 on the U.S. dollar versus the CAD. So we've locked in some profits on that front. But as I say, as far as the equity targets that we have, we certainly made progress in that first leg of the decline. But I think that we could potentially see another 20% plus probably, I mean, when I'm looking, mostly we're looking at the credit market dysfunction and the contagion that's likely to spread there. And again, this short covering rally doesn't do anything to reverse the longer term trends that we follow. And they are very much still in a bear market. So, you know, in 37, they said that, you know, a lot of people lost their money into the 29 crash, but a lot of people who had been very prudent and retained their cash lost their money in, you know, some of the down legs that happened after that, because they were too quick to buy in and thinking they were buying the dip. And of course, the dip kept getting much deeper. So I'd like to get a little more, first of all, bear markets don't last a month. That's unprecedented. Again, if you look at the median bear market duration, it's about 139 trading days, typically 284, like about a year long is sort of rule of thumb normal, 9 months to even 2 years in that range. So when you get that much technical damage in both credit, commodities, and equities in a month, I think that, you know, you got to be super careful that you're not overly optimistic there. I think that there's more months to go here, hopefully maybe by the fall, but again, we'll have to see to what extent other shocks come round here.
Yeah, and usually when you get one shock, you wind up getting a number of shocks, right?
Well, again, because of the leverage, right? Because of the lack of savings. Now, I will hand it to Americans. You guys came into this particular downturn with a savings rate of like about 8%. Canadians had much less than that. We were kind of like you in the 2006 housing mess, where you had tons of money in housing levered and very little in cash. So we're in that boat in Canada now. Americans have a bit more savings. I think there was a few things learned from the crash of 2006. But it seems like the speculative fever really started to go in the last couple of years there. So I think that set you up with greater vulnerability for sure.
Oh, for sure. And things got so overblown. I want to go back to one thing you said before we go, and that is real estate. So in Florida here, for instance, and it's the same all over, there is no realtors out there. You're not allowed to leave your house to go show a house. You can go online and look at virtual tours, but anyone who's trying to sell a house now, I don't envy them. People, the buyers are very scarce. There aren't any. So effectively, the market has ceased to exist. So we have a breakdown in the market in its primary function, which is price discovery. And when you look at that, that could be lasting damage. Maybe travel will come back after the fears of the virus are gone, the epidemic, but real estate, really there's no market for it right now because you don't know what it's worth. It's as if you couldn't get price quotes on stocks. What would a share of Google be worth if you couldn't figure out what people are buying or selling it for? And that's what we have in the real estate market globally.
Exactly. A friend of mine in Canada is a realtor I was speaking with this morning, and they were saying the exact same thing. You know, everything's literally, no one's wanting to show people their homes right now, and no one's really wanting to walk through any houses right now. So that sector, which again was the bulk of the Canadian growth story since our oil crash in 2016, we really relied heavily on the real estate sector, services, commissions, all the stuff that flowed from that. And so now we've got, you know, this oil crash back with a vengeance, with oil prices in Canada, you know, down the most in the last 18 years, at the same time as our housing market seized, as the same time as what savings people had outside of housing was in stocks and dividend paying stuff, which crashed more than the overall market in this environment. So it's just been a real perfect storm of shocks. But it's the kind of thing which I talk about all the time, because life is this way. You know, you may get away with it for a few years where nothing very bad happens, either on a global level or on an individual level. You know, something can happen to an individual's health or family or, you know, job, even without there being a global aspect to what's happening. Well, now we've got global and individual and everything all hitting at the same time, and people really appreciate why preparing for such rainy days makes all the difference in the world versus being highly levered and spending everything you're making.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's why we really don't know exactly what's going to happen here, and why cheers of the recession ending or the crash ending could be indeed be premature. So anyways, go take a look at Danielle's site, jugglingdynamite.com. Tell us your opinion, kl@carrylutz.com, kl@carrylutz.com, and check out our site, Financial Survival Network. Danielle, we will touch base with you in a couple of weeks. Be well.
Thanks, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.